Now, this is the third in a series of sermons that I've been giving on the Exodus. And I've brought up at the very beginning a lot of questions. I'll throw them up on the board here just to refresh your memory. Most of these we've answered. We've worked our way through all these questions, beginning with when why the Israelites in slavery to start with. They started turning to the Egyptian gods is what happened. Working our way on down, and then this past time, we looked at two of the possible Red Sea crossings. One of them was not actually a Red Sea crossing, but some lakes up near Goshen. And so we looked at that. That didn't seem like it fit the Bible very well at all. And then we looked at a crossing which was at the mouth of the Gulf of Aqaba. And so that brings us to the last of the two potential crossings. Actually, there might be another one or two that some people speculate could be the crossing, but these are the primary ones that people are speculate on. So we'll be doing that today, looking at the question of did the Israelites cross the Gulf of Suez, or did they cross somewhere near the center of the Gulf of Aqaba? Now, let me bring up a map again here that I've been showing you. So we've covered this crossing up here at Goshen. We've covered the one down here at the mouth of the Gulf of Aqaba. Now, obviously, the crossing is somewhat related to where the Mountain of God is, either in Sinai or over here in Midian. Now, I pointed out to you last time that we simply don't know where the Mountain of God is. We don't know. We know, we have a pretty good idea from looking at the Bible in particular, what mountain range that it's in. The Bible indicates that it's probably over here in Midian somewhere, but we don't know whether the exact mountain. We don't have much of any clues on that. And for that matter, if indeed it happened to be over here in Sinai, which seems less likely, we don't know which mountain. There's not much in the way of clues. So, you know, what we find is that why did the site in Sinai become so important and become a fixture of the location of the Mountain of God? And in my research into all this, it seems like probably the primary reason is, you know, I mentioned that we have evidence in the Bible, we have evidence from archaeology, and we have evidence from historians, basically for anything that relates back to what the Bible describes. Archaeology doesn't tell us much at all about where the crossing is. It does tell us something about where the Hebrews were, where the Israelites were in Goshen. But doesn't tell us much about the crossing. And so the experts then, they turn to history, the historians, before they turn to the Bible. And the Bible is we can't really trust the Bible. After all, there's religious fanatics, who knows? We don't really believe there's any kind of miracle like this Red Sea opening and blah, 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 you know, this sort of thing. And so they like the historians. Now, these historians they're quoting wrote 1800 years after the event, up to the 1900s. So they weren't there. They weren't close to being there. And yet they're given almost biblical authority in terms of the eyes of many experts, which is just not the case. So what we're going to do, we're going to continue on here. This is the third in the series, the miracles of the Exodus. So this is part three. And let's begin with this question of did the Israelites cross at the Gulf of Aqaba? Now, this is a particularly interesting one in terms of today, the last day of unleavened bread, because some who support this theory believe that the crossing actually occurred on this day, on the last day of unleavened bread. So did it occur on the last day of unleavened bread? Well, let's look at the situation and see what it looks like. And what you know, I've been in these crossings, I've been asking, what level of confidence do we have when looking at the Bible and looking at any other evidence? What's the level of confidence that we have? Now, so this will be the third of the four that I'm describing. And this one is interesting from several perspectives. One, it shows the Israelites. Let me bring up my pointer here. Yeah, there it is. Shows the Israelites starting from up here near Memphis. Now, Memphis has tended to, throughout the history of Egypt, to be the capital of what's referred to as Lower Egypt, which is this whole area up in here. but as we have seen in some earlier sermons, just because the capital is here doesn't mean all the palaces were here and all the temples. And there was a big palace up in this area, up in Goshen here, and likely perhaps a winter palace for the pharaohs. And this is where the Israelites were up in this area. But it shows them starting from here. Now, back in the early 1970s, or maybe late 60s when he made the trip, Dr. Herman Hay made a trip over to the Sinai and visited the traditional Mount Sinai site. And when he came back, he wrote a series of two articles on the trip and describing what he believed at the time was the path and the timing that the Israelites took when they went out of Egypt and crossed the Red Sea. And that timing began right here, not down in Goshen. And let me show you, I made a copy. It was the 71 year of good news is back in the Worldwide Church of God days. And there was a combined May-June issue that had the first of two articles, and then the July issue had the second article, just as reference. But I've copied this out of those. This came directly out of that one of those good news magazines. And Dr. Hay believed that Ramses was right here. The city of Ramses was right here. Here's Memphis, which is was probably the capital of the Egyptian Empire at this time. So he believed Ramses was pretty close. And he describes why he believed this. And he quoted the Imperial Bible Dictionary. He said the Imperial Bible Dictionary located Ramses up in this general area, which is maybe 10 miles or 15 miles from Memphis, so pretty close. And I looked it up. I looked up the Imperial Bible Dictionary, and that was published in 1866. So it was published way before a lot of the archaeological developments of the 19th and 20th century. So I don't know how trustworthy that is from that regard. but from the sermons that I've been giving you and the evidence that I've been showing you, the archaeologists now believe that the city of Ramses, which wasn't really the city that was there, they called it Ramses because Ramses established his temple there hundreds of years later. And the writers of the Bible, editors of the Bible, was updated so everybody would know what area they're talking about. But the archaeology says the Hebrews were down here, and there was a temple down here and a palace down here from earlier pharaohs. And it was probably maybe Thutmose III might have been the pharaoh of the Exodus. But in any case, this presents a problem that Dr. Hay didn't address in his article, and that is this. the children of Israel are all down in this area here, in Goshen. Moses was up here, going back and forth between the city of Ramses and what he believed would be the city of Ramses, and the capital here in Memphis where the Pharaoh was. And so the problem is timing, because on the Passover night, the night of the 14th, everybody had to lock their doors, stay inside, mark their doorposts with blood and so forth. And they couldn't leave, come out of that house until the next morning, the morning of Passover day. And the Bible also says that they left on the first day of unleavened bread at evening. So they left the next night around sunset. So they couldn't come out till that sunrise that morning, and they were going to leave at around sunset that night. That gives them most 12 hours to get packed up to get to the starting point. And Dr. Hayes says the starting point was up here, which happens to be about 50 miles from Avaris, where we know this was a major area where the Hebrews lived, and in the surrounding area here. Now, 50 miles is a big problem to go in 12 hours. It's in round numbers, it's two marathons. If you were traveling at 2 miles an hour for 12 hours, you could go 24 miles. So that could get you halfway there if you were going that fast. But it'd take you basically 24 hours. You'd be late. You missed the kickoff, so to speak. But to travel 50 miles in one day, you'd have to average about a 4-mile-an-hour pace to get there in 10 or 12 hours, a 4-mile-an-hour pace. How many of you commonly run, jog 4 miles an hour? Okay. Could you do it for 50 miles? Now, I jog around 4 miles an hour or so, and I can do it for 3 miles. And if you held a gun to my head, I might be able to do it for 6. But then I'd die anyway, so it wouldn't make any difference about the gun part. But, that's moving on, to try to travel at that pace. And, I'm the elderly elder. These youngsters, you'd expect them to be able to run about a 6 or 7 minute mile, much less a 15 minute mile. So what's going on? Y'all are slow. But anyway, you see the problem here. They couldn't get there to the starting point where Moses was in time. It just wasn't going to work out that way. And so, what's going on here? They've got... Oops, hit my wrong button here. They would clearly couldn't get there, which means, but there's another alternative. And the other alternative is they left directly from the land of Goshen and headed straight across here to this crossing. Now, this distance from about the center, around Avaris, which we've talked about, over to here is not much longer than going from here. This is about 50 miles to up here. It's about 80 miles down here. So it's not that much difference in time. But they didn't have to make it in 12 hours. If their crossing was the last day of unleavened bread, they had a number of days. They're leaving on the first day. Then crossing the last day, had 7 days. So that's a lot of time to make, 80 miles or so. And so let's consider Dr. Hayes' theory. Let's revise it and move the starting point up to Goshen. where it makes more sense. And then let's investigate the theory from that point of view. All right. As I mentioned, the complications, you got 2.4 million Israelites that had about 10 hours to gather at Mithmas, and that wasn't going to happen. The archaeological research has identified the Hebrews in the city of Avaris and surrounding areas as likely the center of where the Israelites lived. And so I'll put up one of these global earth maps. And so here they've got to gather up from all around this area. They weren't all just in Avaris. They were in the whole land of Goshen, or the eastern section of the land of Goshen. They would have to gather all together, and that would have taken about 10 hours probably, most of the day, just to gather together here and then begin their movement. So what we're going to consider is that it spent that first day gathering together here, and then they headed right on down to this crossing, which makes some sense. This is about an 18-mile radius around Avaris. This is probably where most of them were living, in somewhere in this circle, and so they could fairly easily, in 10 hours, gather up somewhere around a launching point in this area. And so that makes a lot of sense. Then exactly, they probably may well have come down this side of these lakes. This is a Great Bitter Lake right here, the biggest lake in the area. And this was the if this was the path they took, more than likely Moses was expecting them to head on across towards Canaan. But they turned because God told them to, turn. And so they would have gone down this way and crossed here. Let's blow this up some more. All right, here's this area. And let me, there's two possibilities here. One is they came on down to right here and were blocked. And they crossed here. Now, they were definitely blocked here. The mountains right over here come right down to the water. So you're not going to squeeze through there. Now there's a pass right here. And Dr. Hayes thinks that they stopped here because this narrow pass, you got 2-3 million people coming through, that they stopped here and the crossing was over here at this point. But in either case, they're not too far apart, just a few more, you know, from this view, but another 5-10 miles on down the road is all they had to go to get to this crossing. So it was likely one of those. And the Gulf of Suez is relatively shallow. The whole Gulf of Suez is. It's only about, on average, about 130 feet deep. And the deepest part is like 250 feet. So it's relatively shallow compared to the Gulf of Aqaba, but we've talked about already. So in either case, it was not like it was in terribly deep. But 12 miles across at this point, 7 miles across at this point. I'm going to use the 7-mile crossing, mainly because that's the one I could find some actual bottom profiles of the water there. So our complication is that for third one, I've already talked about the others, which we've resolved now, is this the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea? This isn't really much of a wilderness right in here. It's not much of a wilderness at all. And we see in Exodus 13, 18, so God led the people around by the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea, and the children of Israel went up in orderly ranks out of the land of Egypt. And I've shown you some scriptures last time that pointed to the Gulf of Aqaba as being the way to the wilderness of the Red, through the wilderness of the Red Sea. So it raises some questions there. But let's look at a profile of the seabed here across that 7-mile crossing. And these are feet that I'm showing you here. And so it's about 150 feet deep at the deepest point here. And 7 miles, 150 feet, so that's how much water had to be replaced. I mentioned last time the wind didn't do this, and I'll wait till I get to the Gulf of Aqaba crossing to go into some detail on that. But if we stuck the Empire State Building in here, just to give you an idea, you know, about the first 15 stories of the Empire State Building would be the above the water. So it's deep, but it's not that deep, you might say. But if you're 150 feet down and the water suddenly collapses on you, you're probably not going, I mean, it's almost certain you're not going to make it out alive. The panic, first of all, your heart's going to start racing. You're not going to be able to hold your breath very long. Now, a good experienced diver, if he was 150 feet down and his tanks gave out, he could make it to the top, but not under these conditions. So it's likely that everyone would have died, as the Bible says they did, when the Egyptian army. All right, now I've been in all these sermons, I've been mentioning certain problems that were common to all of them that we addressed. This was problem 9 from that, and that's the time travel from Goshen to the crossing. Is it reasonable? Okay. Now we're going to talk about assuming they left from Goshen now and not from up near Memphis. All right, so if we look at the Passover night and Passover day, and Dr. Hay proposed that Passover night was Tuesday and Passover day was a Wednesday. I'll talk more about coming up with those dates when I get to the Gulf of Aqaba crossing. The death angel Tuesday night, they prepared to leave all day Wednesday. And then on the first day of unleavened bread, that evening they left. And then the next day, which is the day of the first day of unleavened bread, did they keep marching or did they observe the first day of unleavened bread? Did they leave Ramses and just go a few miles and then camp? Did they march all night? Did they march all the next day? What did they do? We don't know. That's why the question marks are there. All right, second day of unleavened bread, that night, did they remain camp or did they were still marching at that time? Now, Friday, they were likely still traveling. They were traveling that day. And then we come to the third day of unleavened bread, which would be Friday night and the Sabbath. And they probably did camp at Succoth, if this was the path they took. And this is what Dr. Hay assumes. He assumes that the days that are mentioned specifically that they camped were Sabbath days. Were the days they actually stopped. This one was on the Sabbath. But whenever they stopped, it was specifically mentioned that they actually stopped and rested for a while and went on. So certainly you expect that on the Sabbath they probably did stop. Now, maybe they had lost track of the Sabbath, but remember they were following a cloud, and that cloud knew when the Sabbath was. So if the cloud stopped, they stopped. So we go into the fourth day of unleavened bread, the Saturday night and Sunday. They probably, if they camped for the Sabbath, they probably camped that night and didn't start till the next morning, so they traveled Sunday. And then the fifth day of unleavened bread is Sunday night and Monday. They camped at Etham, probably, according to Dr. Hay's theory, continued to travel on Monday. And then we are sixth day of unleavened bread, Monday night. They camped at Migdal. And then Tuesday was when they were getting ready to continue, but they were kind of blocked. And here come the Egyptians, and they started complaining. And then on the last day of unleavened bread, that Tuesday night, that's when the sea parted. The seabed dried all night. And then the next day, Wednesday, the last day of unleavened bread, they cross the dry land through the Red Sea. Okay, so that's the timing. Now, the question here comes up, well, what about, is this a reasonable time frame? Now, we've clearly got 1, 2, 3 days of travel that's not on Sabbaths or holy days. And I raised the question of, did they travel, say, during the first day of unleavened bread? They certainly did when they started, because it says they started at evening on the first day. Now, when you think about it, they are creating the days of unleavened bread. The Exodus creates the days of unleavened bread. It's when they left Egypt and traveled, those first 7 days. That's the days of unleavened bread. Since they were created them, would God have expected them to rest on them? We don't know. We don't know. But maybe not. I'll show you another scripture that kind of suggests maybe not. But we have at least 3 days and probably four that they were traveling during this period of time. And it's about 80 miles. So if it's 4 days and they're traveling 80 miles, that's about 20 miles a day. That's certainly doable. Around 1.2 to 1.5 miles an hour, somewhere in that range, would be the travel time. So it certainly fits. The travel time fits. What's a little strange, though, is not the travel time from Goshen to the crossing, but the travel time from the crossing to the traditional Mount Sinai. Because that's like 120 miles or so to get on down to the traditional Mount Sinai. But they're around 50 days later when they get there. You know, we believe, and the Bible doesn't say for sure, that the Ten Commandments were given on Pentecost. But they arrived there a few days before the law was given. And so if our belief is correct that the law was given on Pentecost, they probably arrived there about 3 days before, and I'll show you that a little bit later. And when they arrived there, they traveled, 100, 125 miles, something like that, but 50 days. So they ended up traveling like 3 miles a day, or 3.5 miles a day, is what it comes out to, which means they were crawling. Now, they had just left Egypt, left all the very people, the soldiers. They could slow down. But did they slow down that much? It doesn't quite sound right that they suddenly started crawling along. And so that part doesn't fit. Now, I've talked about confidence levels that the Israelites crossed and where they crossed. And so let's summarize here. The route is consistent with the biblical description. But here's another problem, and I didn't mention this. They're heading in the wrong direction. Now, the Israelites complained about everything. Do you really think when Canaan is that way and they're going that way that they're not going to complain? Do you really believe that of those Israelites? But that's what's happening here. They went 125 miles in the wrong direction and apparently never said a word. At least nothing's recorded in the Bible. They just happily went along. It doesn't quite fit. Okay, now, and they weren't really near a wilderness area when they started out, which is the way it's described. The water depths, they're consistent with the Bible. There's little evidence, as I've already talked about in earlier sermons, that the mountain of God was in the South Sinai. And here's another thing, little time for the Pharaoh to reorganize his army. Remember, all the firstborn were killed. That's at minimum probably 5%, probably somewhere between 5 and 10% of his army was gone. That many of his leaders were gone. And so it would have taken some time, and this seems like kind of a short time for Pharaoh to get his army reorganized. They're still burying their dead, and Egyptians like to kind of take some time with dealing with the dead. So that doesn't seem to fit too well. And the travel time seems incredibly slow after they cross the Red Sea. And then there's the Amalekites attack I'll mention this again later on and show you the scripture. But it says when they got near Mount Sinai, Amalekites attacked them. Now, the Amalekites, they were up here around Canaan area. They were some kind of nomadic tribes, but they were up here in Canaan and down in this area here. What were they doing way down here? So that's another thing that just doesn't seem to quite fit. So the level of confidence, 1 out of 5. I'm not going to ask you for a vote because this is the most apathetic set of voters I've ever seen in my life. But I would give it a 2, certainly based on leaving from Memphis. Leaving from Goshen, I might kick it up to a 3, but not more than that probably. There's some things that just don't fit. All right, so let's now look at this crossing somewhere around the center of the Gulf of Aqaba. And we'll go back to some of these problems I've mentioned. How does that fit? Problem 8 was their wilderness at the Red Sea. And Exodus 13:18, so God led the people around the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea. That's the New King James. The NIV says God led the people around by the desert towards the Red Sea. And the Tanakh, the Jewish translation, says, so God led the people roundabout by way of the wilderness at the Sea of Reeds. So they can use the Sea of Reeds here in their translation. So the total distance that you would travel from Goshen over to the crossing I'm going to show you of the Gulf of Aqaba is about 250 miles. That's a good little jaunt. All right, so here's what we're talking about. Whoops, let me go back here. We're talking about them leaving up here and going up here and crossing somewhere in this area here. All right, now, what I'm going to do, I'm going to zero in on this. They'll have to cross this area somewhere. Matter of fact, there is a caravan route that's been identified that goes across here. And they may well have been following that caravan route. Now, let's zero in on that. Here's the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba. Here's the Gulf of Suez over here. So we're talking about down through this area here. Across here. Now, today, let's see, I can't read it here, and you probably can't read it there. That's a little town right here. And this is modern day global satellite. But there is a road that runs across here. And it seems to run pretty much along the old caravan route. And I've zoomed in and followed that road all the way across. The only thing that's there to this day is one little teeny town right in here. The rest of it is deserts, mountains, and that's it. And it was probably just like that, except probably that little teeny town wasn't even there back in those days. There is nothing out there now, and there wasn't anything out there then, more than likely. All right, so that's certainly a wilderness area. Now then, down in here, there, eventually what I'm going to show you is that there's a theory that they crossed right here. And that little spot where I got my marker on, that's a beach. Called Nueva Beach. It's about 3 miles across, 2 miles by 3 miles. And so they believe, some people make a good case that this crossing was there, if it was anywhere along here. All right, so there's wilderness they had to come through here. And then on the other side, there's certainly all these mountains in Midian. There is wilderness there. So they had plenty of wilderness to get to over to the Red Sea if it was the Gulf of Aqaba. All right, so here's the proposed path. Now, I kind of roughed this in because at this scale, I couldn't see the highway. But the highway actually starts along about here and is running kind of parallel to my line, but a little bit north of it, right on down until right here. And then the highway splits. One goes on over right here, and one goes down to Nueva Beach. So so that's the still the pass. And that's about the only highway I could find in the whole area is those two highways. Now, the theory is that they went ahead and left, whether they came, whichever side they came down the lakes, they left, they crossed over here, and probably Moses said, hey, we're just about home free. All we got to do is go around the corner here and go down to the mountain of God. When God said, nope, we're going this way. And they come on down and cross here. All right, so that's the theory. Now, you know, we've talked about Mount Laws down here as popular as an alternative to Mount Sinai. But it could have been any of these mountains. As a matter of fact, if you look right up, where is it? Somewhere right along in here. Maybe you can see it better. Yeah, maybe right up in here. So anyway, there's a mountain up in that area. And it could have been there. Let me show you that mountain. That's up right, it's Mount Ad Dama, and it's right up at the Jordan border in Saudi Arabia, and that's what it looks like. And so some people say that's the mountain. So we'll circle around it so you can take a look. You can see a lot of flat areas around it that could have been where the Israelites camped, certainly. It's rugged, but not too rugged. And again, you see there's a lot of valleys and then this high mountain peak here. So it could have been there. Matter of fact, that would have made some sense because they wouldn't have been heading south again instead of getting ready to head north. You know, so that's another example. Now, I've shown you this one before, but let's do it one more time. Get that started. This is Mount Laws. This is more rugged country. Pretty rugged country here and a rugged mountain. And so, and it has a kind of a mini valley up near the top peak here. But you can see in the distance the lower wadis and stuff. So it could have been there. We simply don't know. There's not much in the way of signs one way or the other. But that gives you an idea of the types of mountains up and down the Gulf of Aqaba, east of the Gulf of Aqaba, in what was then Midian. All right, so some of the problems we discussed with the other routes. Problem three, a route consistent with the Bible narrative, Exodus 14:2. And now here we get into the details of these cities that we don't know where they are. Speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp at Pahaharoth between Migdol and the sea, opposite Baal-zephon. You shall camp there by the sea. So this is where they camped just before the crossing. And as I mentioned before, we don't know where those cities were. So in the previous one, I showed you those cities down there where crossing the Suez. Well, they were just stuck there. Nobody knows where those were. As a matter of fact, there's a theory that they're not cities at all. And by the way, Numbers says the same thing. In other words, they were moving along, and God suddenly said, hey, turn back. Go the wrong way. Obviously, to trap the Egyptians was the goal. But they didn't know that. Maybe Moses did. Maybe God told him. I don't know. But in any case, there's a theory that when you look at the meaning of these words, Pahaharoth, mouth of a canal or a gorge, Migdol, tower or a fortress, Baal-zephon, lord of the north, like some kind of religious area of worship or something like that. All right, now, this is a modern-day map of Egypt, and it shows highways. Remember I was telling you about the highways. you can see here's the tip of the Gulf of Suez, here's the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, and you see this highway right here. This is the one I was talking about, and it splits off right here and goes two ways. Now, this little wedge right here is Israel's land, and it goes all the way down to, they have a sea opening at the Gulf of Aqaba, in other words. All right, so the theory is they ventured on down to here, to Nueva Beach. Now, if that's the case, that would put Etham up here. Maybe Bel Savan down somewhere here. And what they would be doing then is following these wadis all the way down to here. Now, it's a road that goes through here now to get to that beach. Apparently, it's a popular beach. All right, so here's what those wadis look like in that area. Here's what they would have been marching through. Some are wide, some are kind of narrow. So the 2 or 3 million Israelites would have got strung out a long ways walking through here, no question about it. But when they get close to Nueva Beach, here's what they would see. Here's the wadi that empty, and wadi is just a valley that empties into, this is Nueva Beach right here, and beyond that is the Gulf of Aqaba. And then there's the mountains of Midian on in the far distance there that you can barely see. But, and so the argument is that that Pi-Hahiroth is the mouth of this gorge, and that Migdol is one of these mountains on the side. Let me give you another view here. Here's that beach. It's about 3 miles across, as I said. So they're coming down through here, and Pi-Hahiroth is the mouth, and Migdol, either this mountain or that mountain, would be kind of the fortress or the tower. And so it was named that way rather than any kind of town or city or anything like that. Now, look at Exodus 17:8 about the Amalekites. Now, Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. Now, Rephidim was their last stop before they got to Sinai. So they're coming down through here. They cross here, and the Amalekites show up. Once they've crossed, not too long, a week after they crossed, maybe. Now, they roamed up in this area, so it seems more reasonable that they would even have been aware of the Israelites if they had crossed somewhere down in the Gulf of Aqaba. But they attacked. Deuteronomy 27:15 describes it. They Deuteronomy 25, verse 17. Remember what, and this is when they were getting ready to go in to the country finally, after 40 years. And they called, remember what happened back at the mountain of God and the Amalekites. What they did to you on as you were coming out of Egypt, how you he met you on the way and attacked your rear flanks, all the stragglers at your rear, when you were tired and weary and did not fear God. And if you made this trek all the way across here, through the wadis, through the mountains, so you're going to be tired and weary. And this is where they would have been attacked, somewhere down in this area here. Now, problem five, could the Pharaoh's army get together fast enough if they traveled all the way across here? Well, yeah, they could. They had plenty of time. They had almost 2 months, at least a month to get across there to follow them. We'll talk more about some timing later. All right, now we come to the fun part here of this crossing. The Gulf of Aqaba, the geologists believe, probably was formed when those mountains on either side of the Gulf of Aqaba formed by some kind of fissure in the earth, because the Gulf of Aqaba is deep, like a mile deep in some places. Okay, now here's a contour map of the Gulf near Nueva Beach. You see those contours? If you can read the numbers, I think I can read them here. This is 500, 600, 700, 800. That didn't sound so deep until you know that they're in, that's meters. 800 meters is roughly a half a mile deep. 800 meters is 2,624 feet. That's 800 meters. So we're talking about a little, right around a half a mile deep. Now, and they call this a land bridge because this is the shallow part. You go down here, and I think that says 1,500. Is that what that says? My print's so small on the screen, it's hard to see it here. 1,500 is like almost a mile deep, 4,500 feet deep. You know, 5,200 is a mile deep. So it's getting on up towards a mile deep at that point. Now, what does the bottom look like? Well, you put it all together, and here's, now, by the way, it's about 10 miles across here. And this is what it looks like. Now, this is pretty steep. And remember, we're talking about a half a mile deep here. So this is pretty steep. So I did a few measurements of how steep. And it turns out it's about 11 degrees, which means for every 10 feet you go horizontally, you've got to go up 2 feet. Now, that's doable, but it's not going to be easy. Now, wheelchair ramps are limited to 7 degrees, just to give you some perspective. So that's not that bad. If you can push a wheelchair up a ramp of 7 degrees, then 11 degrees is not that bad. So it's doable, but it's kind of steep. Not as steep as the mouth of the Gulf of Aqaba that we talked about, which is very steep. Now, so it sounds doable. It's probably certain, as they were working their way down to this point, if this is the true crossing, they would have been climbing up and down things of this similar. Okay, so I got interested, if this was the crossing, there would be a wall in this kind of triangle here on both sides, this triangular wall. I got to thinking, and it's holding back a lot of water. What kind of force would it take to hold back the water on one side? What kind of force do you think it would take? Well, I did some calculations. Let me get over here where I can tell you the numbers. There we go. The total force to hold back that much water, that deep, that wide, and that shape, it's only about 3.8 trillion pounds, which is 2.9 billion tons. And since I was using the Empire State Building a while ago, it's the weight of about 1,260 Empire State Buildings. That's how much force to hold it back. And that's one side. So I kind of just picture God with his hands, just, oh, man. that is a lot of force. Just as a matter of reference, one of the larger dams in the world is the Three Gorges Dam over the Yangtze River in China. Is 1.4 miles long and about 607 feet deep, and is considered one of the biggest dams in the world. Now, see, I'm a structural engineer, and you may not know it, but structural engineers design dams. And see, we know about water acting on a wall, and we can figure out these kind of things. And so that's what I did. Now, if you want to sit the Empire State Building here, it'd be completely underwater, as you can see. This is deep. This is a lot of water. All right. So let's look at it. Here's the Here's the parted sea, standing up straight on both sides. Here's the dry land that they're going to walk through. Now, did I mention that I was a structural engineer? structural engineers also design buildings to resist wind, like hurricane winds and stuff. We don't design buildings to resist tornadoes. Did you know that? Yeah, we say, hey, take your chances on a tornado. But we do design them to resist hurricanes. And so I know something about wind, too. So I did a little analysis here. Now, for the wind, and this gets back to why I said the wind did not part the Red Sea. And I'm going to show you why now. All right, the wind would have to blow in something like this. Whoops, let me get my pointer back up here. The wind would have to blow in like this, and it would have to exactly match the pressure of the water trying to come back. All right, so how does wind act on a vertical surface? Well, it's near the bottom. The wind, because of the roughness, the trees, adjacent houses, not much wind right down at the bottom. But then very quickly ramps up to a constant after about 25 feet. From there on, it's pretty much a constant value, no matter how high you go. All right, so this is just a kind of a near the ground surface. All right, so that's how wind acts. It's pretty much horizontal pressure on a vertical surface. Okay, now how does water act? All right, so this wind is trying to push this water that way. The water is pushing back. But the water pushes back in a different way. The maximum force in the water is at the bottom. And there's no force at the top. And that's why dams are built like this. Wide at the bottom, narrow at the top. Because all the big forces are down at the bottom. All right, so now you've completed your first structural engineering course on dams. Now, but there's more to it. When the wind blows, how much force does it actually exert on a flat surface? Well, we're going to call that P. And its units are going to be pounds per square foot. So take a square foot of wall. The wind's blowing on it a certain, say hurricane force wind, 75 miles an hour. And so one square foot, how much force is on there? Well, let me ask you this question. You've done some experiments, I bet, with wind in hurricane level winds. Driving along on the interstate, say 70, 75 miles an hour, have you ever stuck your hand out, held your hand flat? How many have done that? Hold your hands up high. You know, it looks like every single one of you still have your hand. It didn't just rip it off. You know why? Because at 75 miles an hour, what you were feeling was about 3 pounds of force. About 3 pounds. See, a 75-mile-an-hour wind will exert about 14 pounds on a square foot of area. Now, I measured the area of my palm, and it's about 2/10 of a square foot. So 2/10 of actually 14.4 would be for 75-mile-an-hour wind, comes out to be around 3 pounds. Okay? So that's not a big deal. Now, suppose you're standing up on a flatbed driving 75 miles an hour. Now your body, the whole front of your body with the wind blowing against it, that area, and I measured roughly my surface area to resist hurricane wind force, and it's about 7 square feet. Now 7 square feet times 14.4 is about 100 pounds. So that's trying to push you over with 100 pounds. Now you can do that, except it's trying to tip you over. So you'd almost have to put one foot in front of the other just to kind of brace yourself. And with a 75-mile-an-hour wind and your feet 2 feet apart here, there's probably about 200 pounds on that back foot to keep you from tipping over. So that's a pretty sturdy wind, because the larger the surface area, the bigger that force. Now that you've been introduced to the physics of wind, I'll give you the equation. What sermon is a real sermon if it doesn't have at least one equation in it? All right, this is the wind pressure in pounds per square feet. 0.00256 V squared, where V is the velocity of the wind in miles per hour, times C sub D. Now, C sub D we're going to take as 1 because it's called a shape factor. Flat surface is about 1. If it's like a kind of a round dome type of surface, then it can be a little bit less than 1. But so we'll just call it 1 here, and we'll ignore that because it's not going to really play a role. But anyway, that's how you calculate the wind pressure on a flat surface. Simply multiply the 0.00256 times V squared. And water pressure, which is acting in the opposite direction. It's a maximum down here at the base, but the water pressure at any point is simply going to be the weight of water, 60.4 pounds per cubic foot, times the depth. Now, if you equate those two, you come up with the velocity squared to hold back the water, given is 24,375 times h, the height, depth of the water, rather, divided by C sub D, which we're taking as 1 here. Okay, so you give me a depth of water, I can tell you what wind speed we need to keep that water from flowing back in and drowning the Israelites. And in fact, I've set up a little table here. I'm going to give the depth of the water in feet versus the wind speed. Okay, now we talked about those shallow lakes that were about maybe 3 feet deep, something like that, mid-thigh high. You know how much wind speed it would take to hold that water back? Only 3 feet deep. About 270 miles an hour wind. That's a super tornado. That's the kind of tornado that you saw in those pictures in Alabama and Tennessee the other week. It would take that much at the base, at the 3 foot level down. It would take that much. Now, it goes to zero by the time you get to the top. So it not only has to be a wind of tornado force at the bottom, it has to be zero at the top. Now, I guess God could do that if he wanted to. But how are you going to walk in that tornado wind? All right, but that's just 3 feet. Let's go to 6 feet. Now we're up to 382 miles per hour, which is the cruising speed of a small passenger plane. If we go up to 15 feet, we're up to 605 miles an hour. Now we're talking about cruising speeds of 747s and things like that. And if we go up to 25 feet deep, 781 miles per hour. Now, 781 miles per hour is slightly over the speed of sound. What's it, 740 or something like that? But it's slightly over the speed of sound. Now, looking back at the other ones we've looked at, what we're talking about here is a depth of about 2,600 feet. At that depth, the wind speed to hold back the water at the bottom, where the water pressure is the highest, is only about 8,000 miles an hour, which is roughly about half the speed of the International Space Station that's circling around the Earth. At the Suez, where the depth was about 150, well, there you only need a wind speed of about 1,900 miles per hour. Again, at the base. And at the mouth of the Gulf of Aqaba, which was about 800 feet, you need a wind speed of about 4,400 miles per hour. So based on this, I don't think the wind is what separated and was holding the seas apart. I just don't. Now, let's look at... See, this is the problem, and what I'm saying flatly, an east wind could not have done all this. No matter which of these we're talking about, it simply is not physically possible. Now, of course, God could do anything. But if you put in that much wind, how's he going to keep you from blowing away? How's he going to keep you from breathing? You see what I'm talking about here. Now, but you say, Dr. Avent, look at Exodus 14:21. It says the wind did it. Exodus 14:21, then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong wind all that night and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. Okay. Now, this would be multiple miracles. Not only did he have these horrendously high winds, but they weren't blowing the people away when they were walking through it. How does that work? Well, remember our discussions on Hebrew. And take a look at this word here, by, and this word here, and this comma here. They're not in the Hebrew. The Hebrew, for articles and some prepositions and stuff, you have to add them in the context. You have to add them. And so it's punctuation. There's no punctuation in the Hebrew. All right, so what I'm going to do is, looking here at this word by, let's get rid of that and replace it by period. And then let's come over here to this and get rid of that. And now let's reread the scripture. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the wind, the sea, to go back, period. A strong east wind all that night made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So, by reinterpreting how to insert the punctuation and these missing articles, you get an entirely different meaning. And what I believe is the correct understanding, that God miraculously, whatever the crossing was, God miraculously separated that. And the wind was the drying force. Now, couldn't he have just miraculously dried out the seabed? Why'd he have to wait all night for the wind to blow? Well, I'm purely speculating here. This is on my own thoughts, my own speculation. If this is the crossing, the Israelites are sitting there, and they're looking at a mile-high wall, or excuse me, half a mile-high wall on both sides. And I don't know about the Israelites, but you really want me to walk out there? Now, maybe if he allowed the wind to blow all night to dry it out, maybe by the next one, it's still there. Yeah, maybe it's okay to walk out there. Maybe God knows what he's doing. You know, so it may have been a confidence builder that it stayed out like that all night just so the Israelites get enough courage to step out into that, which probably was not an easy thing to do. All right, now here, look at Exodus 15, verse 8. And with the blast of your nostrils, the waters were gathered together. The flood stood upright like a heap. The depths congealed. But in other words, became firm in the heart of the sea. So here, this again looks like God was huffing and puffing and opened that thing up. Now, by the way, this word blast is the word ruach, which means wind, can also mean, and it's often used, God's spirit. And so this sounds more like a metaphor, yeah, that God's power did this. You know, see, we see scriptures all the time, the hand of God, this is not because God was out there slapping things around. It was his power that they're talking about. So that seems to be a more of a proper explanation there. Okay, so Exodus 19, verses 1 through 6. In the third month, after the children of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on the same day they came to the wilderness of Sinai. For they had departed from Rephidim and had come to the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness, and so they camped before the mountain. Okay, so this is describing them coming up to the mountain, Mount Sinai. This is after they crossed through the Red Sea. Now, notice when they got there, when they camped at the wilderness of Sinai, it was on the same day they left Egypt, the same day of the week. All right, let's continue reading on here. Moses goes up the mountain. So they're there near the foot of Sinai. Moses goes up the mountain. Now, they didn't get there till that evening. If they get there at the same time they left, it was that evening. Likely, Moses waited till the next day to go up the mountain. But that's an assumption. And another assumption is that the Ten Commandments, as I mentioned, was given on Pentecost. That's an assumption. But we're certainly in that vicinity, according to the dates that are given. All right, so Moses then went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice, keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words you shall speak to the children of Israel." What a deal. So what does Moses do? He goes back down and tells him, Exodus 19, verse 7. So Moses came and called the elders of the people and laid before them these words which the God, Lord, commanded him. Then all the people answered together and said, "All that the Lord has spoken we will do." So Moses went back up the mountain, Moses brought back the word of the people to the Lord. So he went back up the mountain. Now, this probably happened the next day. He went up once, got the message, went down, called the elders together. They had to call the people together. And finally said, "Yeah, we'll do it." Moses back up the mountain again. All right, so that probably took most of the day. But let's continue reading. Now, when Moses goes back up there, and the Lord said to him, "Behold, I come to you in the thick cloud, that the people may hear when I speak with you and believe you forever." So Moses told the words of the people of the Lord. So he goes back down the mountain and tells the people, okay, God's going to speak to you from the mountain. And that was probably the end of that day. And so it goes back up again, probably the next day. Again, these are assumptions on these days, but it just seems to kind of fit the time frame. Then the Lord said to Moses, he's back up there again, "Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow and let them wash their clothes. Let them be ready for the third day, for on the third day the Lord will come down upon Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people." In verse 14, so Moses went down from the mountain to all the people and sanctified the people, and they washed their clothes. All right. So, if that third day was Pentecost, which we believe, then we can start backtracking days here. Let's do that. Now, one day we know precisely, 1:15. That's when they left Egypt. Beginning of the first day of unleavened bread. And now we think we know that on a Sunday, that third day of Moses going up, and when God said the third day is going to come, when Moses is going up and down the mountain, that was Pentecost and the law was given. So we think that's what happened. I think it's a pretty good assumption. Okay, that means that the seventh Sabbath, in counting the 50 days to Pentecost, would have been the Sabbath of the previous day. That would be the seventh Sabbath, because, you know, you count the 50 from the Sabbath that falls between the days of the first and last day of unleavened bread. 50 days would be another Sabbath, 49 days, and the next day would be Pentecost, 50 days. All right. Now, that would be the second day. Remember, he said, clean yourselves up and sanctify yourselves. And you kind of think the sanctification went by observing the Sabbath. And Friday, after Moses came down the mountain, they cleaned themselves up. They prepared themselves for what was coming. Okay, so that was Friday. That would have put Thursday, when Moses went up the mountain twice. And that would have put Wednesday evening when they arrived at Sinai. Now, that's the same day that they left Egypt, Wednesday evening. That's how we come up with these days. There's a lot of assumptions involved here. It's not that important whether it's Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday or whatever, but it kind of gives you something to hang your hat on. And so now we can say, okay, the 17th will be a 117 will be a Sabbath. That would be Sukkoth. And the theory here is these camps that were mentioned were Sabbath camps. So they camped at Sukkoth on the Sabbath. Then we got to Etham. We got to Migdal, across the Red Sea, then Elam, the wilderness of Sin, then spent a week with the manna issue, and then Rephidim. And then they arrive at Sinai, and we can put in some dates. 124 would be the first Sabbath in the count, 2-1, the second Sabbath, 2-8, Elam, the third Sabbath, 2-15, the fourth Sabbath. And we know this because they do tell us, and I didn't put the scripture down here, they do tell us at 2-15 is when they got to the wilderness of Sin. And then 2-22 is the fifth Sabbath, 2-29 is sixth Sabbath at Rephidim, and then everything else fits in, 3-4, 3-5, 3-6, 3-7. And by the way, the second month would have had 29 days if the first month had 30 days. So that's why it counts like that. So just taking a quick look at the crossing of the Red Sea, let me blow this part up and add a few things. The first Sabbath at Etham, the second Sabbath at Migdal, they passed through that night. The sea opened. Then Sunday they would have passed through the Red Sea. Monday morning, the Pharaoh's army would have tried to pass through the Red Sea, got swallowed up. 3 days into the wilderness, they met the Mara, didn't have any water. God took care of that. And then the third Sabbath, Elam. So you can kind of come out with a good argument for these days, but it involves some assumptions. So don't take it as the absolute gospel truth, but it does seem to kind of make some sense here. Now, if we look at the some distances, basically it would have taken about, from the dates here, that travel from Goshen to the crossing. That's about 17 days, according to that list I just gave you on the previous slide. There's a couple Sabbaths in there. They probably rested, so probably no more than 14 days of travel, 13 or 14 days. But they need to average about 18 miles a day, which is doable. But it's a decent pace, but about 18 miles a day. Now, afterwards, they had a couple of weeks, and they only had to go about 45 miles, at least, to get to Mount Laws. They may have had to go further if it was some other mountain. All right, so back to our path here. The time, yeah, it's pretty reasonable. They could have gotten across the Sinai in that amount of the time. I mentioned the cattle drive, 1.5, which is about 15 miles a day. 12-hour days, it'd be 18 miles a day. Covered wagons, 2 miles. I mentioned this to you before. But notice this, Exodus 19, verse 4. You have seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. So God's saying, hey, I gave you a little, what's that, 5-hour energy boost? And he said, I gave you a 10-hour energy boost because you move pretty quick. You know, like Deuteronomy 28:49, it says the Lord will bring a nation against you from afar, from the end of the earth, as swift as the eagle flies. And you're talking about, you're moving at same speed an army on the move would move, is the suggestion of using that phrase here. Okay, like I said, distance about 250 miles, but it's doable. Okay, Exodus 12:32, also take your flocks, your herds, as you have said, and be gone, and bless you also. So they had to usher those herds along too. In Exodus 13:5, and it shall be when the Lord brings you into the land of Canaan, and the Hittites, the Amorites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, which he swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, that you should keep this service in this month. So he's solidifying that. So, would there have been enough food and water? Pretty dry across there. But notice what happened. When they needed water, God provided. They carried some food with them. Livestock can go for days without water. They may get a little skinny after a week, but they can live a long time without any significant water. And I mentioned this before, but while the geography has remained relatively unchanged, the climate has not. That, I just read the scripture, the land of milk and honey. Like I asked you, those who have been there, it ain't no land of milk and honey now. Is it anything but? But apparently it was then, which means that whole area must have been so. Springs existed. Likely more rain. Exodus 3:1. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flocks to the back of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. He was taking them up into the mountains because the desert was getting kind of hot and dry. But there are apparently things growing on that mountain. That mountain is Mount Laws. I don't see anything growing there. Things have changed. Okay, so one last thing to cover here. I'm going a little over time. So I've not taken up the sermonette time that we didn't have. All right, here's a view of the Nueva Beach. Distance across is about 10 miles. Could you get 2.4 million people across there in a day? Is that possible? That's a lot of people. Okay, walking speed, let's assume they're walking about 1.5 miles an hour. If I could have run, I probably would have run across that thing if I could have run. But let's assume they're walking about 1.5 miles an hour. They would probably be in a little bit of a hurry to get on across. Now, I'm going to make an assumption here. And my first assumption is that these Israelites were very socially conscious. And so they kept the right distance apart. 6 feet. So they marched across in columns, 6 feet apart, and the columns were separated by 6 feet. They weren't going to give anybody any disease or anything. So, and that's, you know, they're probably closer than that. But let's see, could that arrangement get them all across in a reasonable amount of time? If each column was 3 miles long. All right, so 1 mile is 5,280 feet. So that's what 1 mile is. So the crossing time, now here's the problem when you figure the time. It's just not how fast one person could walk 10 miles. Because when this lead individual here, let me bring my pointer back up. When this lead individual here, when he gets across, he's gone 10 miles. But the last guy in the line is still 3 miles out. So he's got another 3 miles to go. So the total walking time from first to last guy, that's going to take up not 10 hours or 10 miles, but about 13 miles at that space. So if you take 13 miles divided by 1.5 miles an hour, you come to 8 2/3 hours to get across one column of 3 miles long. Okay, so there had to be more than one column. But that one column, if you divide, take a mile-long column, that's 5,280 feet, and they're 6 feet apart. You divide by six, and then you multiply. That's, you get 888 people in 1 mile. So you multiply by three, you get 2,264 in one column, 3 miles long, spaced 6 feet apart. Number of lines turns out to be 901. You simply take number in one column, 2,664, and simply multiply that, divide that by 2.4 million, and you get 901 rows. Now, 901 rows spaced 6 feet apart is about 5,400 feet, or slightly more than a mile. So what you would have, 3 miles long and a little over a mile wide, all marching 6 feet apart, very socially conscious. It would take them about 8 2/3 hours to get across. Now, we could make it a little longer. We could make it wider, a little wider, because that beach is about 3 miles wide. And get more people across. We could get 3 million across in 10 hours if we want, you know, but just making everything a little longer. All right, now, so what we're looking at is something about a little over a mile wide, a little over a half mile high canal going through here. And if you look closely, can you see it? There's a little red dot right there. See that little red dot? That's about how high you would be walking across there, about the size of that dot. Maybe even smaller, because there's the Empire State Building sitting in there. Kind of scary business. Now, you've probably read at one time or another, they found some chariot wheels in the Gulf of Aqaba. Well, they kind of did. Some people say they actually saw one, but that's protected waters. There's coral covering up everything. And we don't have much in the way of real pictures here in the middle of the Gulf of Aqaba. And they're not, things that they found have not been dated, and so it's very questionable. But here's one that's very popular. This is the wheels of a chariot. It's on the side. This is one wheel. This is the axle. And then this is the other wheel. And this is the kind of things they're seeing and kind of interpreting. Well, that's a chariot wheel. But you get thrown in jail if you go down there and scrape all the coral off and try to prove that. And Saudi Arabia is not the most, and it's controlled by Saudi Arabia, and it's not the most friendly place to get thrown in jail. All right, so the confidence level, and we'll wrap this up here, the confidence level that Israel crossed somewhere around the center of the Red Sea is consistent with the mountain of God being east of Aqaba, is consistent with the biblical narrative. It had time for Pharaoh's army to organize and attack, wilderness crossing, very deep water, but consistent with the Bible. Travel time could be a little tight, but it's doable. More consistent with the Amalekite attack. So what's the level of confidence with this one? I would give it a four. Now, this seems like it fits better than any of the others. But we don't know. We can just look at the evidence. We don't have enough evidence. Let's look at all four of them again. Here are the four crossings. Now, there's some others. Some people speculate that maybe the crossing was up near the tip here somewhere. Maybe the mountain of God was up here somewhere instead of down here, and so maybe the eternity went up that way. We don't know those things. We just don't know. But here was what I came up with, and I gave you in the last sermon. That first alternative, I don't think they crossed the lakes of Goshen. The second one, going down through the Gulf of Aqaba, well, maybe. But there's some questions there. And the third one, a two, if you take it going from up in the area of Memphis as a starting point. But I would kick it up to a three if we're talking about leaving from Goshen. I mean, that's a reasonable alternative, at least a 3, maybe a 3.5. And then the last one, a 4. And like I say, we don't know. But we have some evidence, at least points us towards certain things as, yeah, likely. You know, the big thing are these two scriptures, Exodus 3:1, to me, as the location of the mountain of God, that Moses was tending Exodus 3:1, Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock back to the back of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. He was in Midian. And that just kind of says the mountain of God was in Midian. And then after the Exodus, he's back at the mountain of God, and Jethro shows up in Exodus 18:5, and Moses' father-in-law came with his sons and his wife and Moses in the wilderness where he was encamped at the mountain of God. It just kind of, to me, almost screams the mountain of God was in Midian. Now, some people argue that when Moses took his family and went back to Egypt to bring the children of Israel out, there was something that happened on that way back. God said, circumcise the boys. And there's a big argument because his wife didn't like that idea. She finally did. They circumcised them. But so some say, well, I bet Moses was so upset, he sent her and the boys back home. But doesn't it say anything about that in the Bible? The only other way they could have got back with Jethro was they got to Midian. He dropped them off to visit their father. Her father and their boy's grandparents. So, you know, it just seems to all fit that well. But the thing is, it's nice to kind of look at these things, try to figure it out, see if it makes what makes sense and what doesn't. But when it comes down to it, it's what was wrong with the Israelites? Among all the miracles, I told you, the subject index of my Bible lists 28 miracles during this whole Exodus thing until they got into Canaan. The miracle of the Red Sea, no matter which crossing it was, that's what I would call a super miracle. I mean, that would be so impressive. How would you ever forget that? And God didn't want his people to forget that. How many books of the Bible are dedicated to the Exodus? Basically four. Four books. Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Pretty much all devoted to the Exodus. What else has four books devoted to an event like that? I can only think of one. Christ's life. Four books of the Bible, the Gospels. That's how important it seems God places on this. This that we're observing as the days of unleavened bread. The lessons here, they didn't learn. They walked through the Red Sea. How could they so quickly lose faith in God? How does that work? Every trial that happened, what's the first thing they said? Man, let's go back to Egypt. Every time, that's what they said. What's happened? What happened? Could their first love, and they celebrated when they got through the Red Sea. The Bible describes it. Song of Moses. They celebrated. But that first love just disappeared. Seemingly almost overnight. How could that happen? I think the message is, if it could happen to them, it could sure happen to us too, unless we understand what went wrong. And the next few sermons, I'm going to talk more about that. And the next one will be next week. So I'll see you then.